Oh, hi there. This is M.P. Fitzgerald, author of A Happy Bureaucracy, and I'm pretending to play the jazz piano. You know, advertisements were invented by the devil to make Ayn Rand happy, and no one wants to make Ayn Rand happy. But audio production is expensive, so to keep commercials off this podcast, I've got all three ebooks in the Happy Bureaucracy series rolled into one for the price of a single book, which honestly is the best way to support this podcast. Just check the description for a link and tell your friends about the crazy shit you have been listening to have less friends. Thanks. And now, for something completely different.
Fear and Loathing in the Wasteland. The Happy Bureaucracy, Book 2. By M.P. Fitzgerald. Narrated by Gary Bennett. Author's note. Strewn between drug use, groin malice, and cursing on a level tantamount to sacrilege are even more gratuitous mentions of bureaucracy. These bureaucratic references may not be for the weak of heart. Also, child endangerment. Did I mention child endangerment? Chapter 5. Arthur laid out what he planned to do. Ralph hated it. "Can't we just sit here and wait instead?" Ralph asked, with sweaty hands and a fidgety knee. "I mean, a few hours is not too bad." Arthur looked Ralph over with the same disgust he had for years, except now it was not hidden. "Ralph, one of your men pointed a gun at me. These men are not soldiers, and neither are we. What happens when another one of them acts in desperation?"
"More will die,"
Arthur interrupted. "If we wait until Boyd shows up with the enforcers, there is a strong chance that another one of your men will do something just as stupid as I have planned. On a long enough timeline, someone will crack, and that will happen."
"How do you know?"
"Because, like them, I would crack too. We are bunker moles, Ralph. Our first instinct when we were shot at was to fall to the ground. It is far better that you and I are the ones to do something stupid. At least then we have a say in the outcome. At least our plan includes the safety of the others."
Ralph's eyes shot over to the crowded vans behind them. There were now 6 less men than they had started with, and the engine of one of the vans was still pumping fumes. After a silent moment of contemplating, or procrastination, Ralph returned his eyes to Arthur's.
"Okay," he said. "I hate it, and I think it is a stupid plan, and I think we are going to die. But, okay. I'm ready when you are."
At that, Arthur stood up and dusted off the back of his pants. He adjusted his tie and checked to see if his ID badge was still straight. If Arthur was going to die, then he was going to do it looking like the goddamn professional that he was.
"Good," he said. "Run the second I do it, and don't look back. Get to the van that is running. I'll get to the one that is not."
Ralph nodded and clenched his fist as he turned to the van with the running engine. Arthur opened the van's back doors and climbed inside. He lay low to the van's floor, nearly crawling. The van was dark and hot from sitting in the sun, and the air inside was a labor to breathe. He crawled up to their supplies and paused at them. He supposed that only the crate of Spam was small and heavy enough. Looking behind him, he saw that the nervous wreck that was Ralph had doubled in tentative fear. Ralph's normally stringy hair was now clumped to his forehead from sweat. Ralph was ready to go on the drop of a dime. Arthur picked up the crate. It was heavier than expected, but he moved it along nonetheless. Pushing the crate ahead of him and through the gap between the front seats, Arthur watched as it tumbled to the base of the seats. Suddenly being able to see daylight through the windshield made him nervous. He had to stay low. If he saw so much as a body part of one of the slavers, then certainly they could see his own. He slowly and carefully crawled to the front, keeping himself below the windshield whenever possible.
What would Robbie do?
Distraction. Always distraction. Hell, this was almost plagiarism. Arthur heaved the crate of Spam onto the gas pedal, weighing it down. He took a moment to orient himself and faced the back of the van.
"This is so fucking stupid," he thought, before his mind offered, that's why it is going to work. He was not convinced. If he did not make it, he hoped at least Ralph would, so that Robbie could hear of his stupid plan. She would be proud. Then, without further ado, Arthur speared the ignition crank with his keys and let the engine roar. Arthur quickly climbed back to the seats. A bullet hit the windshield as he did, and Arthur started running. In a second, he was clear of the van and fell face first into the ground beneath him as the van roared forward without him. He scrambled to his feet, surprised to still be alive. Slavers must have taken the bait. Hopefully, they were not quick learners. Ahead of him, Arthur saw Ralph usher the tightly packed agents into the running van. In a breath, Arthur was running. A wave of bullets crashed out at the van behind him. The slavers must have been desperate and hungry for blood. Arthur reached the other van. Get in! Let's go! He yelled as he swung the back doors open. By the time half had piled in, Arthur saw Ralph's van squeal in reverse, turn, then whip forward in the other direction. Agents scrambled to get in, and the van's engine hummed to life. The tires crunched gravel right as Arthur got in himself and shut the doors behind him. Arthur looked through a sea of worried faces and out the windshield. He briefly watched as their distraction, now more of a cheese grater than a vehicle, just as the colonel had promised, rammed into the barricade of mutant cars. But the ruse had been figured out. The slavers were already firing on Ralph's van, which was quickly gaining distance and speed. Arthur sat down at the right rear where he was standing as the driver tried to mimic the maneuver that Ralph's van had executed. The van lurched backward, sending a few agents who still stood to the floor, and then the van turned, and the view of the city gave way to that of the mountain. The van lurched forward, sending the occupants in the back stumbling into each other, and Arthur found his face becoming more intimate with someone's rear than he would have liked. The van gradually became brighter inside as new bullet holes tore into it, leaving piercing beams of sunlight in their wake. A man beside Arthur screamed in agony as he was hit, and blood spread out from the man's shirt at his side. The bullets had an almost musical quality to it. Disorientation spread like a blighted virus. Panicked men screamed, some from pain, all because of terror. Maybe one or two just for the sake of screaming. Supplies that were no longer tied down moved quickly to the back, threatening to crush Arthur, but instead rammed into someone ahead of him, and they crushed Arthur. The sudden bursts of light making their way through the bullet holes became fewer and farther apart. If the shooting had ceased, Arthur could not tell, because everyone was still screaming. Hopefully, the slavers did not want to waste any more ammo. The screaming died down. When it was silent enough to hear the van's motor and the pebbles it violently kicked up into itself, they heard one final report from a high-caliber rifle. Suddenly, the sound of rubber bursting conquered all else, and the van lurched to Arthur's left. The screaming began once more. What's happened? Arthur shouted over the others. But whatever the driver said in reply was lost in the panicked echolalia. They slowed and movement became erratic. The shooter had got one of their tires. Then the driver lost control of the van. In an instant, Arthur's direction of up became his right. The van flipped to its side, and the agents became a human avalanche. Where there was once light on the one side peeking through bullet holes, there was now ugly dirt, before it too was covered with the bodies of the van's occupants. They came to a stop. Arthur's head throbbed with pain, and his eyesight blurred. He could only hear the guttural groans of his compatriots. Someone asked, "Is everybody all right?" And a few seconds passed before Arthur realized it was himself talking. Someone at the bottom of the human pile answered back with a, "Fuck off!" And Arthur's senses gradually came back to him. To Arthur's relief, the sound of bullets was no more. Either they were too far to be hit, or the slavers were waiting for them to come out of the van. Because of the chaos, Arthur had no idea of just how much distance they had got between them. Though the lesson should not have needed to be taught, Arthur learned that day that he should never ask, "What would Robbie do?" It was a stupid and dangerous question, and probably only worked out for Robbie because of dumb luck or a clerical error in the universe. She would be proud, though. Proud and probably stoned. Arthur was not the first to brave the outside. His mind had not yet figured out that the van's floor was now a wall. The agent who had been shot next to Arthur clutched at his side, his wound apparently not a mortal one,
or at least not enough time had passed to find out, and opened the van's side door, which was now above them. The sudden flood of sunlight made the fine beams of the bullet holes, violent as they were, seem comical, and it took a few heartbeats to pass before Arthur's eyes adjusted to it. Before Arthur could object to the other agent's actions, the man was already climbing outside. A smarter, or at least a lazier, agent opened the van's back, though awkwardly. A few agents spilled out into the dry and hot ground that was the outside, and Arthur followed carefully. The city looked a whole lot smaller. One of the bunker's border snipers might be able to make a shot from this distance, but Arthur doubted that the savage denizens of Slaver City had that sort of training. They were safe, at least as long as the slavers stayed put. The sun was hot, still not past its noon hour. They had escaped their immediate danger, but now they might have the uncaring wasteland to deal with. The driver was the last to crawl out of the van, his face bruised from the airbag. Everyone in the van made it out alive, if not a little worse off for it. The driver limped up to Arthur. "What now?" he asked. Arthur froze, then pointed a tentative finger at his own chest. "You're asking me?" he said, suddenly aware that wounded eyes were staring at him. "Yes, you. You got us into this. What now?" Arthur looked to his left, then to his right, hoping somehow that Ralph would be beside him. Ralph's in charge. He... But Ralph's van was nowhere in sight. They had been left behind. The eyes that were on Arthur were afraid. No. Terrified. Whether he liked it or not, they had just elected him leader. The driver spat blood, then winced in pain. You got out of this once, right? What do we do? The driver asked. Arthur was no natural leader, or any leader at all. He was good at filing paperwork and very little else. He clicked his pen, surprised to find that it had never left his hand, then looked out to the mountain. "I'm sure Ralph will turn around," Arthur said, not believing his own garbage. "He'll be back once he realizes we haven't followed. But, until then, we should probably get behind cover, just in case they have snipers." This was not an order, it was asking permission. A few of the agents shuffled in place. "Right, everybody move behind the van," Arthur said, with all the confidence of a middle schooler asking for a dance. The IRS agents were happy to obey. They moved, some slower than others because of various pains, but all of them followed without objection. Arthur checked the time on his watch. It had been only 15 minutes since they were rejected reinforcements because of the lunch hour. Given Arthur's own experiences as a bureaucrat, he knew that the not-my-job mentality of the bunker meant that whoever received their message would probably not pass the information on because he, too, was on a break. They would likely have to radio in again. Still not comfortable in his new shoes as an impromptu leader, Arthur fetched the long-wave radio from the van himself, then joined the rest of the men behind it. Their situation was not ideal, but at least their cover was an improvement. Each of the IRS agents could at least fit behind the van comfortably as it lay on its side and faced the city lengthwise. Assuming they had to be out there for hours, once the sun dipped, the van might even give them shade. But for now, the ball of fusion above them baked the IRS agents, and the van's undercarriage was hot to the touch. The men looked at Arthur expectantly, their eyes begging the question, "What now?" This was definitely not Arthur's department. He suddenly became aware of the fact that he was officially denied this position in the IRS when the job was given to Ralph instead. Yet he somehow had got the responsibility of it anyways, without the pay. If impending death was not around them, like a noose tightening, this would irk him most of all. At least the minutiae of doom always put things into perspective. Arthur faced the expectant eyes and reluctantly did his best impression of a leader. It was a bad one. Men, we have about 30 minutes before lunch is over, but we're still on the clock. So, get to work? Arthur stated. No one moved. What? The man with the bleeding side asked. All eyes were still on Arthur. They could die of dehydration or heat exhaustion. The slavers could hop on one of their mutant cars and take them out. There were too many threats to count. Arthur was only good at doing paperwork, however. So that's exactly what he intended to do. Arthur reached into his pocket and pulled out a pile of folded, violent incident in the workplace forms. Each had the name of men involved in the day's disaster, written down the night before. He unfolded them and passed one to each agent, making sure that the form matched with that agent's ID badge. This was not the best plan. Hell, it wasn't even a plan, really. But maybe the tedious and hollow work of filling out a form would keep everyone distracted from their own woes. If this were any other army, if this were not a generation of IRS agents who had grown up in a federal bunker, there might have been a mutiny. These men, however, conditioned to sign forms, then sign the receipts for those forms, then file the receipts for those receipts, barely protested. Only the wounded man hesitated. The agents sat on the ground and then diligently filled out the forms handed to them. Arthur sat down himself, doing his best to hold back the terrible panic that threatened to overtake him. Personally, he was relieved to be filling out a form. That is, until he had to think about the details. The person on the form he had kept was not among them. Arthur looked up from his form and asked if anybody recognized the name. The man with the bullet wound did. It was for one of the agents killed when the firing began, the one whose body they left behind. Arthur had filed more of these forms than he was ready to admit to. Many of them former enforcers who had worked personally by his side before meeting their untimely death. Senseless death was just a part of living after the war. But the enforcers were soldiers, men and women who lived and died by the gun. Today, a man who was so unprepared for the violence ahead of him that he fell to the ground because of an office limerick died unceremoniously. While the others filled out their forms, Arthur stared at his for minutes at a time. He had only wanted to free those captured, tortured, and sold off by the colonel as commodities, yet he was not prepared for a civilian's death to get there. Intellectually, Arthur understood that the price for these people's freedom would be a heavy one. He had seen the brutality of the slavers firsthand. He knew that there was going to be blood. Yet, the concept and the reality were two different monsters entirely. Like knowing something is dangerously spicy before you eat it, compared to the blood you vomit after hallucinating from it for 2 hours. Maybe the IRS agent, now dead and cooking under the hot sun, had known what he was getting into. But not likely. If he did, it was probably a romanticized version of war. The same kind that Ralph kept playing by. He knew that war was bad, like he knew that a dish on a menu was spicy, because there was a cute picture of a chili next to it. He knew, yet he did not know. There was still more to come. There was going to be more deaths. Slaver City was fortified, and they were staying put. The question Arthur had not pondered yet was this. Will it be worth it? Too occupied with paperwork and their own inner monologues, the IRS agents were oblivious when the enforcer crept from behind. No one saw him coming.
About the author. M.P. Fitzgerald is an author and humorist dedicated to injecting the feverish gonzo style into fiction. You can get Memos from the Wasteland, which is the official prequel to this book, free. It contains hilariously bleak office drama, Robbie's diary, and Arthur's last letter from his father. To get your copy, just head over to his website at mpfitzgerald.art. You'll also get free updates on future audiobooks and more. We hope you have enjoyed A Happy Bureaucracy, by M.P. Fitzgerald, narrated by Gary Bennett. Text copyright 2019 by M.P. Fitzgerald. Production copyright 2021 by M.P. Fitzgerald.
Music by Dustmice. Available on all streaming services and dustmice.bandcamp.com.
Oh, hi there. This is M.P. Fitzgerald, author of A Happy Bureaucracy. And I'm pretending to play the jazz piano.
No one is holding a gun to my head to say this, but they are withholding the antidote. Funding for this podcast comes from ebook and paperback sales of A Happy Bureaucracy, the book. Send a warning to your straight-laced and prudish books on your bookcase by adding paperback copies of A Happy Bureaucracy, Fear and Loathing in the Wasteland, and Post-Apocalyptic Pirates. Just head over to my website, mpfitzgerald.art. Once more, that's mpfitzgerald.art.
Please spare my family. Please.